Hello and welcome to Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. This season, we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. This week, we've got a recent track from indie rock band Cheekbone. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is the award-winning writer and director Heidi Greensmith. Combining a love of stories, film and music, Heidi began writing scripts at the age of 16 and has a career which has spanned creating music videos for Paul Weller, writing and directing the award-winning feature film Winter, and a lockdown project with Brian Cox. Heidi, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for inviting me to this lovely part of the county. I'm still a little bit intoxicated by the scent of wild garlic that is everywhere on sort of every single road around here, which is quite beautiful. Your home has so much character. What do you know about its history?
Well, it used to be three mill cottages. Can you believe that three families lived in our house side by side? And they used to work at the mill at the bottom of the lane, at the water mill. And that's really all we know. There was a fire, and then it was rebuilt from the fire. I think it was about 100 years ago. And then when we bought it, it was with the same, it had been with the same family for 60 years. So it's got such a lovely feeling. That's the first thing we noticed when we walked in. We just felt like home. We felt like we'd walked home, you know. And everyone tends to feel like that when they come here.
Let's start at the beginning. There's no two ways of saying this. You came from a big family.
Mm-hmm.
You're number six of seven children. What was family life like?
It was great. It was very busy. And we grew up in the countryside. My mum was from the east end of London and my dad was from the south of London. He was Elephant and Castle and she was born in the Sound of the Bow Bells. She was a Wapping. She grew up in Wapping. And when they first started having children, they were in London in a flat. And then they managed to move out into the countryside and a sort of natural progression then for working class people was Essex. And so they moved to Essex, little town, and then they moved to the countryside. And we moved a lot as kids, but eventually we ended up living in a windmill. And so there were seven children in a windmill in a tiny little village that we must have seemed completely crazy. You know, my parents with all these kids, and my dad always had some sort of classic car on the go. So there'd always be some mental, like, you know, really cool MG or something. And he'd have that in pieces on the driveway. And all these kids with their bikes riding around the village and dogs. We always had lots of dogs and generally animals. We had a ferret once. But it was pretty idyllic, actually. You know, it was very, we were a strong unit.
Yeah. A sort of inventor father living in a windmill sounds a lot like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
It really does. But he wasn't like him. He wasn't nothing like Dick Van Dyke. He loves the law. He was a legal clerk. But he knew everything about the law and he knew how to win an argument. And he, you know, he sort of prided himself on knowing everything about every argument. He would quote arguments in an argument with him. He would quote someone else's argument. he'd sort of learn arguments. So it was a nightmare, really, to have any kind of conversation with him. Whereas my mum was like a Mother Earth. She was a real, you know, she would pick the blackberries for the jam and she would make apple pies every day. And but she would always work as well. They were both working, so we were at home alone a lot. There was generally all us kids on our own. For the summer holidays, it would be every day, all day. You know, we'd be sort of getting on with that.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, actually, I'm one of four, which these days is, you know, considered relatively big, but the sheer practicality of sort of getting anywhere was always, you know, a little bit of a hassle. So I can just imagine, like, how do you get a family that big from A to B?
They used to shoehorn us into a Saab estate. And we all sat on each other's laps because there were no child seats or seatbelts even then. They had the seatbelts, but you didn't have to wear them, did you? And so we would all sit on top of each other. And there was these two seats at the back of the estate that faced the wrong way. You know, they faced out. And if you sat there, you guaranteed to throw up by the end of the journey. And we've all got these horrific horror stories of, now there's things none of us eat. Various different things, because we used to see it on the floor by the end of the journey. And we used to go to the beach a lot and get winkles and cockles and things from, and I always remember seeing those sort of coming out of their shells on the floor of the car. It was hit, that back seat was like a nightmare. I could make a horror film just based on the back seat of the Saab estate. Live winkles and vomit and God knows what else. Probably some dog shit there as well, because we always used to bring the dogs.
Oh dear. Do you get the same feeling when you sit backwards facing on a train now?
Yeah, I can never ever go backwards. Not even in a restaurant. Mind you, that may come from my gangster great uncle. But I always have to have my, you know, my, I always have to be facing the door, basically.
Right.
Of any room or any, although I'm not now, weirdly. Lewis, we might have to swap. I was feeling really uncomfortable and I thought it was just talking, but no, I've got my back to the door.
Okay. I'll tell you if anyone is coming.
Will you? With a gun?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
I have to ask about your great uncle now.
My great uncle it's a very glamorous story, but it was probably really horrible, and it's not to be glamorized, but you know, us kids thought it was glamorous. As we got older, we started thinking, oh, blimey. So he was George Cornell, and he was shot by the craze in the Blind Beggar pub in Whitechapel. So in the film of the craze, you know, the old film with the Kent brothers playing the craze, he's played by Stephen Berkoff,
right.
Which is nuts, because when I was... I did theatre before I did film school, and I loved Stephen Berkoff, and I went to see him at the National Theatre in a Brecht play, for example, and then he played my great uncle in the film about the craze. It was nuts, but yes, so he was my granddad's brother.
What then was your first creative outlet?
So I used to sort of act out things in my bedroom. We had, like I said, we had lots of periods of time where we didn't have parents around because they were both working. And so we were left to our own devices a lot. And they were quite good because they'd say, oh, no TV until we get home. But then there wasn't really much on in the day anyway. You know, it was really different, wasn't it? So I used to just act things out in my bedroom, and I really thought I wanted to be an actor. I really loved it. I really loved just being somebody else, and I loved the words. You know, I'd sort of memorize things very easily, bits of books or films. I'd remember the film, or if we were lucky enough to have something on VHS, like we had Jaws on VHS, as soon as it came out we got it. And I watched it like every day, and I knew all the words, and I would just be, you know, I'd take it in turns to be each character. Really weird. So I would have been about 11 doing that, I think. I think it came out in 1981 on VHS.
How much of it do you still know?
Oh, all of it. I mean, don't watch it with me. It's really, really...
One woman show.
Yeah.
Jaws.
Jaws and Young Frankenstein. They're the two films I know all the words to.
Were they the kind of stories that appealed to you then?
Yeah, I really liked that sort of slightly dark, but not fully. Like, I didn't like horrors. We would watch horrors as kids. It was awful. My brother was older than us. So there was one boy and we were, and then six girls. And he was in charge of the VHS rentals. So they'd send him off and he'd come back with whatever he came back with. The whole family would sit and watch it, no matter how old we were or young we were. So we were watching The Exorcist at the time The Exorcist came out on VHS. And I know that was, I was still really young. So, but funnily enough, you'd think, oh, maybe I'd want to do those sort of films because they were ingrained so early on. But actually, I've no interest in horror whatsoever. I like stuff that makes you feel good after. So I have no inclination to make horror films. But I love those sort of slightly off-kilter films, you know. So I loved Mel Brooks films. And I love, hence Young Frankenstein. And I loved, like Jaws was like a real, it was like a sort of drama, but then it had the sort of horror of the shark within a drama. It wasn't a horror film. That's the kind of film that I loved, absolutely loved.
It is one of the most perfect films.
Yes. Yes.
And actually I was reading up on kind of early Spielberg and how Duel is, you know, is Jaws, but with a truck.
Yes. I mean, he is one of my top five directors of all time. He's probably in my top three, possibly in my top two. But he's so clever and innovative. And even at a young age, you know, like with Jaws, with the camera work, he would show the shark's point of view and that had never been done. You know, and how affecting was it? And it changed cinema. And also just the sheer size of the film changed cinema, because before that we didn't have we never had summer blockbusters.
Yeah.
That created the summer blockbusters. So, you know, that was such an early film and he was making it up as he went along. And it was such a good exercise in going with your gut and making it up and allowing yourself to make it up as you go along, instead of constantly checking yourself or thinking I should be referencing something bigger than me or better than me or something that's been done before, just to really have the conviction to go with how you're feeling.
Yeah. When did you realise that filmmaking was what you wanted to do?
I went to do theatre studies and I knew that theatre wasn't for me. I wasn't 100% sure still then that I wanted to be a filmmaker, but then I kind of started putting two and two together. Oh, I really am obsessed with films and I like acting out the films. Wait a minute, let's see what happens if I go to film school. But I was also equally obsessed with the sea, hence again, that's, you know, why Jaws is a perfect film for me, is it's got a lot about the sea, especially when they go out on the boat in Jaws. From the bit that they all get on that boat, that's when the film really comes to life for me, because they're on the sea then. And they treat the sea, you know, the sea becomes their entire environment. And it's not just about the shark, really. It's about them, you know, in this new environment. And so I was obsessed with the sea as a child and still am. And so I didn't know whether I wanted to do that maybe as a job. So I applied to do marine biology. And it was a very specific course at Derby University where part of the course was to do with filmmaking in the sea. It was the only course in the country that was doing it, where it had this sort of section of underwater photography.
Right.
Filmmaking, basically. So that was the course for me. So I applied for that. I got a place. And then I think my theatre studies teacher said, why don't you apply for film school as well? So I did. And I got a place at the London Film School and I had to choose. And so I chose London. Because the other place, I think it was really sort of a geographical thing. I didn't really want to be in Derby, I suddenly decided. And then, and so I, and Covent Garden looked much cooler, so. For a teenager, nothing against Derby, but, you know, it was fun.
Yeah.
So our film school was next door to the Pineapple Dance Studios. So it was just a really cool place to be.
And I think at the time as well, as a young adult, you know, the early 90s, it was sort of the end of Thatcherism. And I think in British film, there was kind of a resurgence in independent cinema as well. People like Mike Lee and Danny Boyle, who'd been around for a while, but their work was becoming more acclaimed and more well known. So you must have been, you know, itching to get behind the camera at the time.
Yeah, I was doing more camera work at film school. So I learnt a lot of lighting and I learnt camera, and I really still wasn't thinking I'd direct. And then I left film school and started as a runner. Like you do, you start right at the bottom, no matter what training you've done or what schooling you've done. You've always got to start at the bottom unless you're incredibly lucky. But I think it's very important to start at the bottom because you need to learn every single bit of the industry to really be able to, you know, especially if you're going to be a director. It's really wonderful if you know every job inside out, because, you know, you're asking other people to create a vision with you, and so it's nice to know really where they're all coming from too. So I started in documentaries at a documentary film company, and we did gritty undercover documentaries, and that actually is the thing that sparked off my love and need to do some sort of fictional direction, because the documentaries were kind of too hardcore for me. It was too real life, and I knew then I just didn't want to do real life, and I'd been sort of fighting against real life my whole life, and that compounded it. And I was like, that's it, I'm gonna direct, and I'm not gonna do documentaries. So I kind of winged it. Like, I think a lot of filmmakers end up having to wing it at some point. And I wrote a short film. I'd never written anything before, and I forced myself to write this short film. And it was about a guy who drills a hole in his head. And it was called Up Stood the Ape. And I left it by accident in a bar. I went to have a drink with a friend, and I had it on me. And I was showing it to my friend or talking about it with my friend, left it on the table. And whenever from day one I print a script out, it has my contact details, or now it has my agent's contact details, but then it had mine on. Automatically, when you print it out, they just go on the front page. So someone rung me the next day and said, I've got your script from, you left it in the bar. And I was like, oh, that's okay, you can just bin it. And she said, oh, I'd really love to give it back to you. And I said, honestly, bin it, you know, it's fine, it's on my computer. And she said, no, it would be really nice to meet. So I met her just at the same bar, which was in Hoxton Square, where I was living at the time. And she said, do you know what? I love this film. And I've got some money that I'd like to invest. And I was just thinking what to invest it in. And I'd, you know, if you haven't got your finance yet for this, I'd like to invest it. And I said, well, you know, she said, how much do you think it will cost to shoot it? And I said, I mean, off the top of my head, like 30 grand. And she said, okay. I was like, really? She said, yeah, I'll give you 30 grand to make the film. So that was my first film. And I shot it on film, on 35 mil, black and white. And it was such an eye-opener and such a, you know, I really got the bug. That was it. I couldn't ever do anything else after that moment. And then that got me signed to make music videos.
Who did you look for in those early years for inspiration? Was it other filmmakers, authors, photographers?
So there's a photographer who happens to also live in Somerset, called Dom McCullen, the great Dom McCullen, and he was one of my biggest influences. I just absolutely loved how many stories were in each still frame of his work, and I would be obsessed with staring at his photographs, normally at the South Bank, you know, at the Photojournalist of the Year Awards. And I would go there every year and I would stare at many photojournalists' pictures, but especially his, and they always seemed constructed. They were so incredibly dramatic and they told so many stories that I felt like they'd been, you know, it was like it was a drama. It wasn't a documentary. It was something somebody had put together. They'd done this with the lighting, they'd done, and it, but it was, because it was real life, it was so affecting and it was just the most incredible drama, you know, you could get, that I'm became quite obsessed with them. And so I would say that was one of my biggest influences to begin with. And then obviously I grew up watching Spielberg and Scorsese and who are my two favourites, really. Woody Allen, I've loved his sort of human comedies, you know, how he observes the humour in drama and in dramatic situations, and even, you know, comedians, Gene Wilder, huge influence. Everything that Gene Wilder's ever done has affected me, I think. So it's been sort of people, actors, obviously directors, yeah.
You mentioned the world of music videos, where you got to sort of put your talents to that. As a music fan yourself, what is it like directing rock stars?
It's really fun. And they're, you know, generally, I love music. So if I get to go to work and do something with music and the people that make it, I'm just so happy. And still, I feel like that. And I use music heavily in all my work. And I even write to music. Music's as important in a way to me as the visual. So, you know, my husband Dominic he wrote the score for my last film, Winter. He's doing the soundtrack for my next film. And I love nothing more than sitting with him and listening to a track that he's come up with, and he's got a writing partner at the moment called Amy Newton, and she's singing on some of these tracks, and you know, I get lost in the music, really. And also I can see a whole scene play out while I'm listening to it, and then I'll go and tweak the script because I've heard something in the music that's affected me to want to change the script. So I know a lot of filmmakers work the other way around, but I like to work. I always love to have music first, and I think that may have come from music videos. I don't know.
As you said, you met your husband, Dominic, while shooting video for Reef. Was there an instant connection between you?
Well, actually, we did meet just before that, and there was an instant connection. I saw him coming up these iron steps at the back of, I lived in this little warehouse building right in the middle of Hoxton Square. And my neighbour was a member of Reef, and they were all getting together for some reason. And I opened my door, and coming up the steps was Dom. And I thought to myself, and no word of a lie, I'm going to marry that man. And it was not that long after that that I did marry that man. But yeah, and then shortly after that I shot their video, and then that's where it all started.
And it was around that time, I think, that you sadly lost your mother. Did they get to meet
once? Yeah. I brought Dom to the hospital to meet her. She was kind of, she had breast cancer, and then it went to her bones. And at the time he met her, she died, I think, 3 weeks later. So she was really heavily on morphine and stuff. So I hope that she, you know, remembered him, or, you know, I hope that she sort of noticed what I saw in him. But I said to her, I'm bringing someone, because we weren't taking anyone to see her at all. But I said, I had to bring him because he's really special and you've got to meet him. But she died actually much quicker than we thought, because I don't know whether it's different now, but the hospital kept kind of saying, oh, we think she'll be fine, you know, and we could all see that we thought she wasn't going to be, you know. It was really, it was constant. And then we'd say to each other, but they say she's going to be fine, you know. And so it was quite shocking, even though she'd been ill and she was very young. It was quite shocking when she did go. So I didn't expect her to go as quick as, I thought she might have a bit of time with Dom, you know. But so she died in August, and then we found out I was pregnant with our first child in September. So it was such a huge emotional year.
Yeah.
And Dom and I hadn't been together for very long at all either at that point. We'd got together in the June. So, but it was such a, it didn't matter. None of it mattered. It was all so crazy and fast and hectic and, you know, life and death. But it seemed perfect in a way, the chaos of it.
Mm.
You know,
at that time, were the band touring a lot?
Yeah, they were. And I actually was ill. I had this mad episode of my pancreas decided to give up. And we'd gone away for a weekend together, and I ended up in Plymouth Hospital. And I sort of came round. I was really ill. We didn't know why. And I'd kind of kept passing out. And they took me in an air ambulance to Plymouth. And I woke up. And there were these amazing, incredible ladies with big white hats, because it's a naval hospital. And they looked like they were floating around. I thought, I promise you, I thought I was in heaven. It was all light, and there were these women with these big white hats that were floating everywhere. But I was in Plymouth Hospital, actually. And Dom was on tour, and he would come and visit me from tour. So at one time, he got a taxi for 200 miles to come and visit me for a couple of hours, and then he got a taxi back. And the nurses thought it was great, because we would all sit on my bed and watch him on the TV. He'd be on Top of the Pops, or, you know, a kids' TV show in the morning, and me and all the nurses would watch him. They all gave me special treatment because they all liked Dom, I think. yeah, it was just a mad time. There was so much happening, and... you know, I don't know why I went off on a tangent about being ill. Oh, I know why, because then we got back to London. I got back to London, and I was kind of still, like, everything was a little bit uncomfortable. And I was, you know, wondering how I was going to get better and stuff. And somebody said, oh, you need to see this other doctor. He's amazing. So I went to see that doctor, and he said, I'm going to scan you. And he did a scan, and he said, okay, so I've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is you've got a cyst on your pancreas, which is what's been making you ill. And it's full of pancreatic acid, and it's 18 centimetres long. And it can burst at any minute and kill you. So we have to get you in for major surgery tomorrow. And I was like, oh my God, this is like unbelievable. And he said, yeah, oh yeah. And the good news, I haven't got to that bit yet. You're pregnant. So anyway, it seems like it's been like that, our relationship. It was from the beginning. It's just been sort of a whirlwind of amazingness.
Not lacking in drama.
No, but mostly good.
Before moving to Somerset, what experience did you have of the area?
So Dom's from North Devon, and we used to have a house in Cornwall. So we would, you know, we've both been through Somerset a lot, but we hadn't spent any amount of time here, really. And then Dom had a lovely lady who used to work on his tours doing the catering, and she lived in Somerset in Batcombe. And we, every now and then, would visit her, because we, especially when my mum passed away, she became sort of like a surrogate mum to me. And so we'd visit her when we had young babies. She was brilliant like that. And we fell in love with Batcombe, but it took us some time to actually find a place in Batcombe. But that's when we started visiting Somerset. So it was really just from that one person.
Was it an easy decision to put roots down here?
It wasn't, in that we kept thinking we wanted to be by the sea, and we kept looking in North Devon. But at the time, we both needed to be in London quite a lot. So it was a bit of a pull. You know, we were sort of, okay, well, we'll go to Somerset for a bit, but we're going to end up in it, by the sea. So it was like, we weren't expecting it to be as amazing as it was when we got here. And then when we got here, we were like, actually, I think we made the right decision.
From a life of travel and being surrounded by people to being, you know, a mother in the countryside with your children, it must have been a little bit of a shock.
Yeah, it wasn't in the way that I had been in London and been really busy. But then again, it was almost like going back, because I grew up in the countryside, and there were long periods of time where it was kind of just me and the country, and me and the dogs and my siblings and our pets and stuff. So it was reminding me a lot of that. And I would think back to what my mum would do with us. So that was a huge influence on my mothering in the country, was thinking about what my mum used to do and the days she used to take us out, and that it was okay to just pack up a picnic and go a couple of fields away and not feel like you have to go in the car, or not feel like you've got to go to a soft play centre or something like that. It was, the countryside was enough for the kids, and that was such a valuable lesson to have learned from her. So, you know, it was busy in different ways, because the kids obviously keep you very busy.
And it was sort of pregnancy and motherhood that really spurred you on to write in earnest a lot more than you had been.
Yeah, it definitely did. It's such a tonic, I think. Even to write for anybody to write anything down is a tonic. And I think if you're feeling a bit isolated or a bit down, you know, hormonal fluctuations after babies can really get you feeling down. The writing in any capacity is going to help you, I think. I always say to people, just start writing stuff down, anything. And it just gets you out of your head. And so I did that. But then I started sort of thinking, well, if I'm writing stuff down, I may as well start trying to write something down that I might make, maybe. So that's how it started, with script writing.
Do you think there's something about the exhaustion, I suppose, of being the mother of very young children that opens up a certain honesty in your writing?
I think it may be to do with the exhaustion, but I think it's more to do with the sort of zero bullshit that you'll accept as a mother. So you start really realising what's important, and, you know, you haven't got time for any kind of bullshit. So you're not going to spin any yourself, you know. I think that really is a huge change when you start having children.
Do you also find the sort of beautiful surroundings to be conducive to your writing, or does that not really affect you?
Oh no, it really massively affects me. I get inspiration from it for the actual work, but I don't think I could do it if I didn't have it. You know, it's because I go for a walk every morning, a long one, and I used to run, but getting on now, can't run anymore. After many injuries, I've stopped my running. And yeah, I just soak up nature before I sit and write. And I couldn't do it without it, honestly.
Are there any spots or views that, you know, you'll be drawn to if you need particular inspiration?
I love hugging trees, and I'm not even kidding. I do. If I'm really stuck, I go and hug a tree, and there's a particular one I love at the top of the fields up there. I think it's called Crow Hill. Crow Hill in Backham, guys, go hug that tree. It's really good. And I love walking by the river because I love that flowing water. I think that's really good for creativity. I mean, we do drive down to the coast as much as we can. So we go to North Devon and Dorset. I mean, even, you know, right on the Dorset border of Somerset. Where did we go the other day? It was an hour from here. And you just go into Dorset and you're there. Lulworth Cove. God, it's amazing. An hour away. And so much inspiration there. I mean, I sat on the beach watching the kids playing, just having hundreds of ideas.
We mentioned how big your family was, and you now have a big family of your own, five children. How do those two sort of family lives compare? What are the similarities and differences?
Well, my dad wasn't the best dad. And, I totally forgive him for all of it because everyone has to move on. I don't harbour anything. But he did make lots of wrong choices in bringing us all up. And but we are all the people we are because of it. So, you know, whatever. But the big difference with our family, I think, is having Dom as our kid's father, and that I can fully rely on him to be a good dad, you know, and I don't think my mum had that, and that was a real shame. I feel more for her about it than us, because he's my partner, he's fully my partner in parenting, and I think it's really important. It's really amazing for the kids. You know, so that's a huge difference. And also that we're creative and we're doing things we love, and thank God we can. Whereas my mum was creative, but she could never do it. She loved to write poetry and she never got anything published, and she wasn't encouraged by my father, whereas Dom encourages me every day to do what I do. So, you know, it's just we feel a lot freer to express ourselves creatively and be parents, you know. So I think that's reflects on our children, and now they're all becoming very creative.
To what extent do your own experiences of those sort of intergenerational relationships find their way into your writing?
Lots of my scripts are all about... Well, they're all about families, and they're all about the relationships either between a mother and or a father and their child. I mean, that's always at the core of them, but I think it's at the core of a lot, isn't it? You know, because it's the basis of a person. It's where they came from. So it's always in there somewhere. You know, there's a script I've written called He Made the Stars Also, and that's all about the mother-child bond. But then in my film that I'm doing now, Like Sugar, it's about what they didn't get as children that's informed how they behave, you know, as they're growing up and becoming adults, the two, Casey and Mary in that film. So it's always there. It's just in varying degrees.
As a new feature for this season, we're showcasing Somerset's musical talent, with tracks from local acts in each podcast. Cheekbone are Ernest, Lou, Stell, Nick and Keenan. While their name is an obscure reference to the Mighty Boosh, their music is pure guitar-driven indie. They've been played on BBC Six Music and featured on Soccer AM. Released in February of this year, here is their single, In and Out.
long and you're in it all. And you're in it all. You know it's hard to raise a child when you don't even love yourself. And it's hard for me to see, 'cause the way you see it,
I'd like to talk a little bit about your first feature film. You mentioned it already, Winter. How long had that story been one that you wanted to tell?
Winter was a funny one. It was born out of my mum dying and how my dad didn't cope very well with us as kids grieving and his own grief. And so I wrote it when I had my fourth child, and I was feeling really blue, and I did that thing where I've got to write and it'll make me feel better. So I did that, and Winter came out basically, and I wrote it in like no time at all, 6 weeks or something. And I didn't even go back over it. That was it. That was the one we shot. Yeah. You know, so it was a bit of a therapy maybe.
And the production time was quite short as well.
Yeah.
So how difficult was it sort of going through all that, not just the filmmaking process, but the emotional process of what that family goes through in such a short period of time?
Well, it was a godsend because I didn't want to be harbouring on that for too long. It was painful. I think it was painful for a lot of people involved. You know, some of the actors found it very cathartic, but painful during the process, and I did, and you know, it was good, it was quick, and I think it benefited from it being quick as well, because it was really just so from the heart, and so you know, the process was how it needed to be for that particular film.
Yeah. You mentioned that everyone sort of went through it and everyone sort of had to go through the emotions, the pain. But I suppose the reality is that the emotional core of the film is around the father, Woods, played by Tommy Flanagan. To what extent is your role as a director about allowing him to feel and kind of process those emotions versus giving him support and being a bit of a rock for him?
Well, he, you know, he fully embodied the character. And I know he drew on some personal life experience for that, but I think actors do with every single role they play, and they'll find it anywhere. A good actor will find that personal life experience to draw upon. You know, even if they're playing Hannibal Lecter, they'll pull something from their own personal archive that can connect them to that character. And I'm not saying that Anthony Hopkins was a serial killer, but what I'm saying is that he would have had some dark feelings in his life at some point that he could have drawn upon to be able to embody the character with a humanity and an authentic, you know, so the authenticity of that character is believed by the audience, you know, otherwise it just doesn't work. All I do is, I suppose, fully believe in that actor to embody that character and just support them with that sort of embodiment, really, rather than going into any of their personal stuff.
Something that struck me about this and some of your other work is that the focus is not necessarily on the big event itself. It's on how the characters respond to that. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I think that's because I think it's the journey sometimes that's important, not the event at the end. So you could be doing something to get somewhere. You know, you hear these stories about Olympians that, in fact, we know a person who was training to be in the Olympics, for example, and they spent 4 years getting there, and 2 weeks before they broke their leg and they couldn't compete. And the 4 years, they said, was a waste of time. But of course, the 4 years wasn't a waste of time. The 4 years was the journey, and it took them somewhere they wouldn't have gone before, and they would have met new people and all the things that are involved in the journey. And I see that in the film as well. It's never about the end result of the film. In fact, the end of the films are never my favourite ever bits. It's, you know, and it's always kind of like, yeah, whatever at the end. But I mean, they always have an ending, but it's, yeah, it's, life's not the end, is it?
In the time since Winter was released, how much do you think has changed when it comes to mental health and men's mental health in particular?
That's a really good question, because actually when we made it, there wasn't much to do. And there wasn't, I mean, there wasn't much to do about it. You know, when I was doing a bit of research, because obviously it was based in personal experience, but then my main aim of it was that it would touch others. So it couldn't just be about one person. It had to be inclusive. And so I had to research it. And I did that with the help of people like Mind, the charity. But when it came out, we would do festivals with it, and audiences would come and say, I've never seen a film like this. I've never seen a film that talks about male grief or explores male grief. And then that's when I realised, actually, it's really underexplored, especially in cinema. And I think possibly still is. I mean, I think there's a few more things, like there's the Riz Ahmed film Sound of Metal now, which I know sort of is about male mental health, and that's a very current film and a very different film to Winter, but I hope it's explored more, because it's still underexplored. But at least now, like when we made Winter, there wasn't, I don't think we had Mental Health Week, for example, but now we do, so that's great. You know, stuff moves on.
Last year, quite soon after the UK was put into lockdown, you got involved in a project which was only possible through working together over video calls. Can you tell me a bit about that experience?
So a producer called Maggie Monteith phoned me up and said, I've had this idea, and it was very early on. It was in March she phoned and said, I've got this idea that I want to do a TV show in the pandemic. We're shooting the pandemic, but also it's born out of it because we're going to do it on the Zoom. And by then, like, I don't think I'd even done a Zoom call at that point, so I had to get the kids to show me how to do that. And then she got me on board, Dolly Wells, who's an actor and a director, and Susie Ewing, who's a director and a writer, and she got us all together and she said, I'm going to, well, over the next sort of 10 days, we worked out that we'd take two characters each. We would develop those characters, we would direct those characters, and we would write a whodunit, and we would come up with an idea why all these people were trapped indoors, because we didn't want it to be the pandemic. We wanted it to be escapism from that, because we wanted people to watch it. We didn't know at that point how long it was all going to last or anything. And so we decided they'd be agoraphobics, and that's why they were stuck in. And the whodunit part of it was because they'd lost their therapist and they needed to speak to her once a week, or, you know, what would happen. And so they all start talking to each other. And so that's how it came about. And we had to learn how to do that with the help of a brilliant technical crew. We worked out how to film everyone at the sort of highest quality, how to record everyone at the highest quality, and then how to put it all together.
It must have been tricky sort of not being able to control some of those sort of decisions, I suppose, in terms of, you know, lighting and how all the tech is set up at the actor's end.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it was quite freeing because you couldn't really do that much. So what you could do is maybe reposition a lamp, but you couldn't light a whole set. So you knew that. So that took away quite a lot of your jobs that you usually have as a director. You could only work with their wardrobe, essentially. We did send out a few things, but, you know, it was quite freeing. You didn't have to look for a location, apart from a choice of rooms, yeah, possibly, but not entire locations. You couldn't really film outside, so they were all interiors. It was quite freeing, and it's always good to have parameters. It's like, if you've got a tiny bit of money to make a film, there's only so much you can do, and you get really inventive with that, and it can sometimes give you great ideas because, you know, you have to really think about it. Whereas if you're just given everything you ever want, you don't really... You know, there's no sort of magic to be found sometimes because you're not having to really work for it. So I think it was the same with that. We were given such tight parameters, in a way, we had to really work to get some magic out of it. And it worked, and because the actors were on board with that, and so they did the same. And it's all in the performances, that show. I mean, the performances are so good.
It's obviously a new way of telling a story that has evolved out of necessity rather than design. Do you think that way of filming and telling stories is here to stay?
I hope not. I don't like it. I think that, you know, the stuff I love is very cinematic, personally. I like going to the cinema. I like large format. I like, you know, if I'm watching something on television, I want it still to look incredible because I like to be transported. I do not want to look at a Zoom call. You know, that's not transporting me anywhere. And if I'm going to look at that, well, then may as well maybe just listen to it and imagine some visuals instead of being stuck with a Zoom call. I don't think it's great for the kids either. You know, I think it's really... I do worry about the kids getting stuck in these computers and they're very addicted. We all know they're addicted to screens. We all know that this pandemic has heightened that further. They couldn't even do school to get out of looking at a screen. They had to look at a screen all day for school. And I think we really need to move away from it as soon as possible.
So what are you up to next?
Well, I'm just casting a film that we're shooting in the fall. It's in autumn. Keep speaking to American agents, I have to say the fall, but it's autumn because we're in England. And it's really exciting. It's a road movie called Like Sugar, and it's got a rock and roll theme and soundtrack, and it's quite young, two female protagonists. So we've been working on that for a while. We kept getting pushed because of the pandemic. And then we're struggling with shooting slots because everybody's trying to shoot at the same time, unfortunately. But we've managed to pin it down to shoot from late September. So that's next.
Is that in the US you're shooting?
No, we're shooting in the Canary Islands.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. It's set in Spain.
Right.
It's a UK story, but it's the two British girls end up in Spain. And then I've got a World War One drama called The Golden Hour, which I'm just finishing another part of the script, and then it's done. And so we're hoping to set that up to do after Like Sugar, which is completely different in that it's period and it's set in the war and it's a true story. But it's, in a way, it's got quite a few similarities because they're two independent women who, you know, won't settle for what they've been given. So it's got a similar theme to Like Sugar.
And do you make choices about the sort of production in terms of film, digital, depending on like the story that you're telling as well?
Yes. Yeah. So I'll design it with my director of photography and we'll decide what we're going to shoot on and how we're going to grade it and, you know, if we're going to... Everything we do. And then with the production designer after that, I'll go through what we're going to do colour-wise and... yeah, but the best thing I think about filmmaking is collaborating with others. It's wonderful because, you know, you do... I write the script generally on my own. My producer will give me notes and sometimes I'll have a script editor. But there's not much involvement from others. That's just me. And then the best bit is when I get to work with other people and get their amazing brains involved because then I feel like it's really going to come to life and... They give me other stuff I never would have thought of.
Finally then, in your time in Somerset, have you discovered or been inspired by any local stories that you want to capture and tell through the medium of film?
Well, I mean, there are so many incredible people here. I can't say a specific story. Every now and then I'll hear little bits and I think, ooh, that's such a good story. But I couldn't put my finger on one right now, but I bet there will be, because I'm constantly inspired by the people that live in Somerset and the stories from Somerset. You know, I'm always saying, oh, is that true? Wow, that's amazing. You know, so I think it's only a matter of time, really. I'm just quite busy on the ones I've got already. But I think the minute there's a gap, I think something could possibly come in. I mean, I'm really influenced by Somerset and I love being here so much and I love the people here. You know, we're getting so many amazing people suddenly turn up and amazing places to go and, you know, we're so lucky.
Heidi, thank you so much for your time. It's been a delight talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.